شوم. زندات.
February 21st, the penitence of Sugrunda. Fourth day in this hole. M will pay for what he has done. The flesh will be torn from his treacherous bones. Low buzzing permeates the atmosphere here, bounces from the angularity of the off-kilter structure. Everything has an ochre tinge. There are melodic sounds somewhere. A keening voice. Cannot be the experiment, surely. Why would they blame us for that? For the last several hours, the resonance off the walls, what could that be made of, has conducted the buzzing in a more regulated fashion. If only these fiends would negotiate. But they have simply sat outside these long days. March 2nd, escape to Algriesk. Moving again. The vehicle is unfamiliar, cannot see how it's powered. We make swift and silent progress, however. The air here is thick, fetid, but at least we can make up time. Those fools. Minimum human casualties, and it's all sackcloth and ashes. If I never hear their damnable night cries again, it'll be too soon. M will pay, though. If the machine parts meet us when we get there, I can begin immediately, as long as the conducting crystals arrive. The frequencies there are much more conducive, much more harmonious. Thank you. 23rd March, in the villa of Trask the Vulgarian. At last, a space to work in. The resonances here are much to my liking. The outbuildings are fashioned from some sort of reflective material which only exhibits that quality at night, I'm told. It also seems to sigh when touched like some sort of enormous animal. A huge ambient sigh of deep contentment. I wonder what would happen if I took the trepanator to the walls. Our host is most congenial, though possessed, of course, of a deeply questionable past. Supper promises to be interesting. He wishes to debate with me on matters of brainwave projection into analogous forms like sound waves. Old hat, of course. I think the poor fool wants to build a thought-activated sound weapon to use in his pitiful desert wars. Perhaps he can be converted to the cause. And after dessert, we've been promised hermaphrodites. The steps of Mikros. Trask has committed some of his dirty money to our project, so a profitable detour from our original itinerary. As long as we provide him with both a sound weapon and some subjects on which to experiment, that is. The propensity, even the vogue, of petty dictators in ramshackled upstart states embarking on ill-conceived eugenic experimentation just, it seems, because they can, really confirms all my convictions about the baseness of human nature and the arbitrariness of the arrangements of political power. Luckily, our destination nears. Moving the machine parts by sea has proved a very valuable, if time-consuming, precaution. And it means we can move more freely here, by caravan, and appreciate the sound worlds left behind by the old god. Those heretics would have changed human evolution if they hadn't gotten greedy. Moving in their footsteps is a rare privilege when I can afford to reflect on it. The steps contain many of their echoes.
Remember.
March, the Whistler Station. Once, when I was a child, I travelled with a railway party comprised mostly of the discussion circle of my father's cousin, a rich and benevolent fool, to a remote northern location. They were engaged in some deadly dull and worthy ethnological research into a dying tribe's about-to-be-lost language. It was there, on a clear, still, and cold night when the aurora borealis danced in the sky, that I heard my first whistler on a transceiver I'd rigged from stolen electronic appliances. What was immediately clear was that this was communication of a highly dense and sophisticated nature. It seemed then to my unformed mind not to be alien, but to be a jagged set of algorithms composed as music by an intelligence far beyond our own, music that would reveal to us the real meaning of the biosphere. So I set myself to decoding the keening pulses of white noise, an endeavor that lives with me still. Some, of course, say that they are communications from beyond the grave, a quaint notion I am happy to allow as one indulges a child who is not yet ready for the truth. The Whistler Station, overlooking the steps, is a place unlike any other, except, of course, for our destination. The power of the place flowed through me as I looked down the thousands of feet of the plateau and away across the gnarled wastelands that houses so many secrets. And there came the regular bursts of organized white noise, a stochastic throb of rare beauty. 22nd June, Arcanos Revisited. I always felt inspired by stopovers here. The air is full of the memory of machine noises, the machines that once made the destination of this journey the wellspring of all our hopes for the future. The virus that struck down my colleagues, those astounding minds, all extinguished too soon, should never have happened. And we were on the brink of our great discovery. I remain convinced of it. Why it did not affect me is a mystery I shall always return to and solve when I have the time, although it is clearly to do with my altered genetic structure. Arcanos crackles with energy, which once took shape in the prototypes of our dark and powerful sound machines. Its cobalt buildings remain angular and defiant, unchanged by time or the attempts of our enemies to unlock its secrets. I managed to siphon off some of the stored UHF transmissions. They'll come in handy when we need to test the machine in a few months' time. Osterfelt leper colony. The fascinating thing about leprosy is that it coordinates a completely new resonance between bodies and spaces. I had heard about this colony from some organ merchants we encountered on our long and creaking journey up the tortuous coastline. We detoured considerably to satisfy my whim to capture some of the slowly vanishing echoes from the long derelict village. it will not disappoint. My long exposition in my youth on the differences between lepers and the plague dead-ended in the grandest social experiment of that phase of my work, captured in my now notorious account, The Leper's Limbs and the Plague's Embrace. What was most fascinating to me then was the way in which these spectacular diseases changed the way human beings and their buildings conduct the sound frequencies that run through them both. Our deep-rooted prejudices in favor of the visual and the tactile mean that we cannot understand how wavelengths carry all meaning, even our self-perception. When the leper loses the sensation in his limbs, and then the limbs themselves, the sound of his movement changes, as do the dimensions and resonance of his inhabited space. The plague victim, in turn, moves from the outside to the inside, forced to heed only the sounds of the four walls around them, and the voices in their heads entreating them to account again and again for why they should live. Large cities are thus always plague cities, imagining that listening is private, as if sound frequencies could belong to a simple four-walled space and its lonely auditor. I digress. Osterfeld is a typical walled metal village with low-roofed burnished huts surrounding a central courtyard, which doubled as meeting place and ritual burying ground. Few remaining examples of the leper's epic trance music, which formed an essential part of these rituals, have remained extant in their entirety, which was often weeks in the performance. Many fragments of the music, like fragments of their decayed bodies, have broken free of the villages and floated into so many other wavelengths. The courtyard showed much evidence of its active role in Osterfeld's ancient history. Bone fragments were liberally strewn, especially around the totemic staffs of retribution, stationed evenly at 5 points around the perimeter. The air here vibrates with blood, rotting flesh, and the memory of the ocean's wholesome tang. I took with me some items for the reliquary. I will analyze them later and try to assign them a physical identity. Some of the ancient inhabitants of the place were possessed of mythical power. 22nd September, the sanctuary regained. We have arrived at exactly the right point in the sonar cycle. Work must begin immediately, and while the slaves set up the equipment for calibration, I have time to ruminate on all that has happened between now and my last visit to the sanctuary a generation ago. In that time, I've seen so many of my ideas become garbled into detritus of any number of mass media conspiracy theories and the crackpot justifications of genocidal dictators. When my original group of wavelength shamans first discovered the sanctuary, it was evident to us that certain arcane propositions put forward through history regarding the confluence of sound, space, and time were, in fact, correct. As its jagged walls swoop down to the ocean's level, the multiple layers of compacted and fused plastics form a sound projector of unparalleled power, as well as a natural amphitheater which acts as a monstrous sound crucible, a cosmic mixing desk for all the old gods of all life and of all chaos. It was with a group in mind that we made a collective decision to install the original machines there. As it took shape over the years which followed, we took inspiration from the susurration of the ochre ocean which lapped the outskirts of our hellish sound colony. And now, all these years later, the scars on the landscape and the atmosphere above it have begun to fade. Work can recommence, and I can be sure this time of building a channel for the correct frequencies that will have the results we so devoutly wished when our original machine took shape. Dreams that dissolved along with the flesh of my brilliant co-conspirators. Revenge needs to be unleashed on those who orchestrated that viral attack years ago, and on those now who have attempted, like M, to stand in our way. But they are not the only ones who will suffer.